This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
So to introduce myself, hi, I am Corinne Blaylock. I'm the Executive Director of the Law and Political Economy Project, also known as the LPE Project. It is a network of legal scholars, students, practitioners, and organizers developing scholarship and strategies to democratize our political economy, build people power, and work toward a more just, equal, and sustainable future. So this panel starts from the premise that law and the courts will not save us. But it asks if and how they can be an effective side of struggle. Because whether you are invested in climate, reproductive justice, abolition, or debt relief, the courts are going to be a problem we all have to contend with. And each of our amazing panelists is approaching this question from a different angle. So I've been asked to keep the bios for our speakers exceptionally short, but there are longer versions in the conference page, and so you can find out more about their incredible work there. So starting to my right, Ryan Dorfler is professor of law at Harvard Law School, whose research focuses on the role of the judiciary within a democratic system. Next to him is Lindsay Muniak, an organizer with the Debt Collective, where she leads national efforts to abolish medical debt, interrupt patterns of financialization in healthcare, and bring those who have experienced the failures of our for-profit healthcare system into the fight for its transformation. Next is James Soto. He is an advocate for incarcerated people who currently works at the University of Chicago's Center for the Study of Race, Politics, and Culture as a community justice practitioner and fellow. He is a system-impacted person who spent over 42 years wrongfully convicted. He is now an executive director at Walls Turned Sideways and a founder of a campaign called Build Communities, Not Prisons, aimed at closing dilapidated prisons and building pathways for early release here in Chicago, which he will tell you more about. And finally, we have Shrylin Grace, who is the senior policy advisor at the Cook County Public Defender's Office and a founding member of the Chicago Community Bond Fund, where she served as the organization's first executive director. Shrylin also helped found and lead the campaign to pass the Pretrial Fairness Act that eliminated money bail in Illinois. Okay, so the format for our session, so each of our panelist is going to speak for about 10 minutes, after which we're hoping to invite a sort of genuine discussion and engagement from the audience for about 30 to 40 minutes, and then we'll sort of let our speakers have a final word before we adjourn. Okay, I'm going to hand things over.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Corinne. Thank you all for coming. I really appreciate it. So my work over the past 3 or 4 years has been devoted primarily to urging a reassessment of the role of courts, both among liberals and also on the left. At a more abstract rhetorical level, the aim is to bring people to, rather than viewing this malign Supreme Court as some sort of dangerous anomaly, the thesis is that we ought to see courts more generally, in particular federal courts, as anti-democratic and historically reactionary institutions. Now, that rhetorical, theoretical argument connects, obviously, to ongoing practical political campaigns, both to reform and to confront, again, the federal judiciary in particular. The basic argument is that once we see courts as generally malign institutions, we could then, in turn, should see that the goal of reform should not merely be to capture the courts, staffing them with progressive judges and justices, but instead to weaken or even abolish courts. Redirecting their decision-making authority toward institutions that are either directly reflective or at least more responsive to the popular will. Now, in making that case, I, along with my co-author, Samuel Moyne, have offered various technical solutions to the problem that I'm happy to talk about. But again, I think it's more important, the more important goal here is to sort of understand the problem as being courts in general, rather than being courts in particular. I think that's the sort of important thesis to take away. Now, unsurprisingly, a lot of the messaging in this campaign has been directed at liberal audiences. The opportunity for the real sort of live opportunity for reform is traceable directly to the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and in turn the capture of the Supreme Court by GOP reactionaries, which has activated a broad liberal opposition, owing most obviously to the court's abortion jurisprudence, but also the court's jurisprudence on issues like gun control. However, despite this liberal orientation, I do think that this moment is a real moment of opportunity for the left. Most obviously, federal courts are historical opponents both of labor and environmentalism, and taking this moment of left-liberal convergence of interest to create a more favorable terrain, much in the way that it's critical, I think it's an opportunity to create more favorable terrain, much in the way that it's critical for the left more generally to take advantage of analogous convergence to enact changes to, for example, federal labor law or federal environmental law. This convergence with liberal interests is a necessary condition for this being a feasible political program, I don't think it's a mere liberal reformist project inherently. And here I want to make a more general point that the project of reforming and confronting courts should not be understood as a separate issue, right? An issue or a goal sitting alongside other issues like union expansion or a just transition. The argument here, our thesis is that disempowering courts is a necessary condition to succeeding in any of those other areas. And so in that way is better understood as a part of those substantive goals. And so one thing I'm hoping to hear from all of us, or one thing I would hope to have here is like a real conversation about how better to integrate the push for court reform with other existing movements and projects, and how people in those different communities might be able to help one another and so on. And also just how different groups see the issue of courts, right? How, from different issue areas, how your experience with courts is. And here, actually, Corinne helped use this helpful metaphor, you know, the sort of idea of like, oh, different people like grasping at different parts of the elephant, but not seeing the whole thing. I think sort of seeing how like all of you in your various specific capacities encounter courts, I think might help to develop a broader picture of courts and the law more generally. And then just the last thing I'll say, although most of the reform campaigns that I've been involved in sort of pushing for have been mostly legislative, right? Sort of acts of Congress that could affect in various ways the powers of federal courts. In the meantime, I think it's also important to take seriously to focus on other methods of creating pressure, and in particular, other forms of more direct confrontation. So earlier this year, Sam and I wrote an essay, for example, on ignoring or defying judicial judgments. Something that, for example, a president could do even without a governing legislative majorities, without governing legislative majorities. And here, just to use one sort of concrete illustration, the Supreme Court's continuing obstruction of Joe Biden's student debt cancellation actions is helpful here and connects obviously to the work done by the debt collective. So again, exploiting electoral vulnerabilities of Democrats, the debt collective and other activists successfully pressured Joe Biden to announce his plan to cancel a very large amount of federal student debt, only for that plan to be obstructed by a reactionary Supreme Court. But rather than letting Biden have that excuse, right? However, activists instead popularized the demand that Biden needed to push back against the easy to anticipate Supreme Court judgment, up to and including simply ignoring the Supreme Court's order declaring cancellation unlawful. Now, obviously, that more extreme demand went unmet. Biden did, however, immediately answer a new, more tailored cancellation program and has separately promised to cancel smaller chunks of student debt, though, again, including very recently, with ongoing judicial resistance. But again, this is all just a way of saying that confronting courts, even within an electoral framework, needn't be limited to legislative reform, and that more radical actions like defiance, noncompliance, and obstruction should be understood both as tools in and of themselves to limit judicial authority, but also tools for creating pressure on elected officials to take legislative action. Okay, I'll leave it there.
Oh, sorry. Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming to our panel to kick off socialism this year. So as Corinne said, my name is Lindsay Muniak. I'm an organizer with the Debt Collective, where I lead our work on healthcare and medical debt, which we really see as a lens onto the fundamentally cruel, economically extractive nature of our healthcare system. And I also have some comrades, colleagues here who work on other debt types. And in general, just by way of a short introduction of the Debt Collective, I mean, that you offered some great context for some of the fights that we've been involved with, including student debt, for student debt abolition. And our general framework, though, I think is important to name before I start talking, because a lot of people have started over time to sort of associate us with the demand for debt cancellation, which is a good thing, right? We want debt cancellation, but we also want debt abolition. And what we mean by that is we want to end the economic system that produces indebtedness as a consequence of people seeking things that we believe should be publicly financed public goods. So healthcare, education, housing. What in a lot of ways, the debt question is sort of like a lens onto this question of public goods and what we can and should demand of our state. And build, right? And build the power to take. And so when Corinne asked me if I'd be up for joining this panel, I was like, perfect. I've been thinking a lot about the law, the courts lately. Amazing timing. This is great. And then as I was thinking a little bit more about it, I was like, oh, I'm actually just always thinking about law and the courts. There's nothing hugely unique or singular about this timing. It's just something that like runs through the entire stretch of my time at the Debt Collective, certainly, and before that, even if I didn't necessarily think about it in those terms. And so I think one thing that as an organizer on this panel, as someone who's non-attorney, who has no kind of like paralegal experience, exceptional legal knowledge, everything I've learned from brilliant legal minds who are like part of the Debt Collective and part of the kind of like network of fellow travelers that we have has been from them rather than from like a law school. And so I think that that's important first of all to name, because I think a lot of us begin to think that in order to act at the level of the law, in order to act on the law, to act on the courts, we need to be lawyers. And that's just not true, as I think many people in this room have come to understand through their own organizing experience. But I also know that there can be a tendency among us on the left to sort of to kind of like disavow the law as a site of struggle, to be like, well, fuck the law. It doesn't serve us. What good is it? Which I totally understand as an impulse and spent a lot of time feeling that way. I do think, and obviously this is like a kind of like strong current in the discourse that we're probably all engaged with to varying degrees at this moment, that if we want to build power and claim power, we need to engage with the law. We need to engage with the courts. And with the courts in particular, I think it's also a question of what we're leaving on the table by kind of discounting the courts as a site of struggle. One of the things that really struck me when I first joined the Debt Collective a couple years ago, I guess like 2.5 or a little bit more years ago now, was the positions and the legal analysis that I was hearing from these comrades and fellow travelers who did have really strong legal backgrounds, who were maybe trained attorneys, legal scholars, people like the folks I'm on this panel with. And I had, over the previous few years, spent a lot of time working on state legislative campaigns, sort of progressive, well-intentioned, and like successful to varying degrees, legislative campaigns. And I had gotten used to thinking about the law as a sort of like the experience of engaging with the law as just butting your head against a wall repeatedly and like doing nothing except injuring yourself. And so what really kind of shocked me as I started to encounter people who had been working on the law from a slightly different vantage point. What is the level of malleability in the law? And I don't know, I mean, I, how many people here, actually, I should ask, have some sort of like legal experience, whether it's like you're an attorney, you're a paralegal, you've been a paralegal. How many people here do court watch? Keep your hands up. How many people have done court watching? Nice. Okay. So I think a lot of the things I'm saying are probably things that a lot of folks here have like thought about or encountered similarly to varying in different ways. But I think that the malleability, the fact that even when we're talking about like law that's in code, is not something that's totally static. And we've certainly seen the right use that to their advantage over the past decade and take the opportunity there to like drive their political project forward in a way that we haven't done. And I think that I'm, you know, I don't want to kind of place blame for this with the left. I think that obviously the kind of liberal approach to the law plays a huge, huge factor in the fact that we haven't done this more effectively. But I do think that we are leaving a lot on the table if we don't think more seriously and strategize and build projects that actually do engage both, one, like the kind of like the actual like law that's in code, and two, the courts, like through our organized power. And so I think as I think about the law in relation to my work, there's sort of like two poles of encounter that I think are most important. And one is working with people who are much smarter and brilliant, more brilliant with like regulatory code, legal finesse than I am, to think about what space in existing law there is for us to pry open and stage potential interventions that, you know, that draw on like organized people power in relation to the code that's there. What we can do, this is effectively in a lot of ways the program that like the right has engaged in. You're using the fact that the law is not static, that it is a dynamic thing, that it's open to interpretation, that lawyers who have a particular ideology, I mean, we can pretend that it's a neutral objective. There's a neutral and objective reading. And I think most of us in this room probably would say that's just never the case. And so using that as an opportunity to identify places where we might have leverage and can really stage actions. And I'm happy during the Q&A to talk a little bit about some ways that we've done this. That's something that I think we need to be doing more of across our projects. And then the other is at the level of like action on the courts, right? So how can court watching folks raise your hands again? Nice. Okay. Yeah. I just got excited again. So there are a bunch of people in this room who have, who I would love to hear from during the Q&A, like both your reflections in addition to any questions, just on what power you've felt you've been able to generate in those spaces, like what, and lessons, right? I think this is something in general that we can all stand to do a little bit more of is talk about like our failures. And I'm using that word, like not in a kind of judgmental way, like, but just talk about things that don't work, obstacles, be candid about in settings like these, especially be candid about what those have been and think about ways that we can kind of strengthen these projects that we're engaged with. But a lot of the court watching that takes place right now is really focused, understandably, on criminal courts. And something that we've been exploring is this question of whether it would be possible to kind of mount an aligned court watching project on that would focus on debt collection court. Because this is an area where there are like almost comically, almost to the point of parody in a lot of cases, like really no eyes in the room. In Philly, debt collections court is heard in like a judgeless room. And people obviously frequently can't show up, et cetera, et cetera. But so thinking about bringing eyes, first of all, ears, and then like people into those spaces, like at the level of just the power that observation like has, but also at the level of the power that solidarity and demonstrations of solidarity can have is something that I think in general, it's exciting to see more and more evictions court watching taking shape, and obviously the projects that have continued to go strong, which it seems like a lot of folks here are part of. And I know we'll have more time to discuss later. Before I pass it along, I also just want to say that for all of the kind of the urgency with which I feel that we have to like not fall into this trap of being like, oh, it's the law, like fuck the law, you know, what has it done for us? Like the left has to kind of like exist beyond that, which, you know, I don't even think is entirely untrue. But but I do think that it's like a dramatic oversimplification, and that it can like kind of drift into irresponsible approaches to the law pretty easily. But when I think about the way that like some phrases, I was just at a conference or like a convening a few weeks ago where we had like all these rich and interesting discussions about courts, and then at the end of the conference, as people were reflecting on the things that they got from it, there were multiple people who were like, the importance of data, the important, like the end. And like, for any of us who are materialists, right? And I think that there's like something about this that, oh, like now I'm thinking about the law. Now I'm thinking about data. Like if we're materialists, we know that these things are things that can be used against us too, right? And that they're kind of like sites, if we want to talk about like sites of struggle, I would say that data is also a site of struggle. It's a site of struggle, which means that data can work against us, the law can work against us, and that there's nothing inherent in it that means that it's works to the favor of the left rather than the right. And so I think maybe that factors into the disavowal. But I want, as we're like continuing to spend the next hour together, I want us all to kind of like think about, how to kind of like, how to ensure that we don't fall into that trap of totally neglecting the law, and that we also don't fall into the trap of pretending that just like being like, now we have the law on our side, like that's somehow organizing or building things. And with that.
All right, as Corinne said, during the introduction, I am the longest serving exoneree in the state of Illinois. I served 42 years being wrongfully convicted for a crime I didn't commit. So I have a unique perspective when it comes down to what I'm going to speak about, and which is prison abolition. I'm also an organizer, and I'm a paralegal at the Northwestern School of Law. I got my undergrad degree while I was incarcerated last November. I got out in December of 2023. So as one can imagine, the law very much affects. another thing she didn't mention, I'm a self-taught prison litigator in there. I don't like the term jailhouse lawyer, but I'll take it. I am going to be going to law school next year, by the way, as well, to help others advocate for them. All right. Traditionally, social movements from the left emerge to challenge or change some sort of injustice or inequality. Such movements usually find themselves within the realm of law and politics. However, the law is not merely an apparatus to advocate for any left interests, but it can be an intricate part of to advance that issue. Left movements build on advocacy and movements operating in tandem. This includes critical legal studies, like recruiting lawyers or law students or law professors or any volunteers, critical race theory, and feminist or queer legal theory. Drawing on such works by Mari Masuda, Kimberly Crenshaw, and Derek Bell. I will illustrate how the law invariably intersects with left movements, specifically how prison abolition is aligned with issues like housing, food deserts, water insecurity, mental health, and a whole host of other issues. This intersectionality of the carceral abolition struggle invariably requires a navigation through the legal system. Before I begin, I want to say that I recognize that institutions of law and politics are structured to serve the status quo, those who hold power based on capitalism. I would argue that this is the very reason why social movements must challenge or contend with the law as an apolitical entity, because the law is both political and relational to our lives. After all, the governance of the law is designed by enforcement through an unbalance, a distributing of wealth and power to those because of their skin color. But we have seen throughout the U.S. history that it can be produced and shaped by grassroots organizations who contest policy and treatment. Most notably, the civil rights movement, voting rights, the end to Jim Crow, and the protests like indigenous water rights against the North Dakota oil pipeline were successful in their efforts by directly challenging the law. I'm familiar with the idea of movement law, which is something I'm going to touch on just a little bit. Movement law should not be confused with the scholarly study of social movements in and of themselves. More succinctly, it is a way to think outside traditional legal praxis and align with movements. It is a way to find different ways to challenge power. Because see, challenging power isn't just about going out there and protesting like we saw recently with the DNC. It has to be on all fronts. We have to challenge policy when need be. And yes, we have to take it to the court. And we have to speak the truth, because speaking truth to power is an important component to any movement. As Blaise Pascal said, justice and power must be brought together so that whatever is just may be powerful and whatever is powerful may be just. And finding justice in this day and age is not an easy thing. We've seen the devastation that they've done, that's going on in Ukraine, that's going on in Palestine. We've seen things like Black Lives Matter movement come out of the deaths and the shooting by law enforcement. And we just see the same thing happen. This cycle continues over and over again. In Chicago, we had one happen with Dexter Reed, who was shot a number of times simply because he had tinted windows or he didn't have his seatbelt on. Well, when we talk about movements, I myself am immersed myself in a movement at this current time, which is Build Communities, Not Prisons. It was birthed in June following the death of one of my cohort and friend, Michael Broadway. Michael died because of the awful conditions at Stateville. Stateville had an independent engineering report in 2023 say it was uninhabitable. I want you to really understand that. This was a building that I myself, during a think tank with the Neighborhood Prison Art Project, which Alice Kim was a part of, and she's here to support me, and I'm thankful that she's here. I talked about how I live in a sick building that should be condemned. And in March of 2024, our governor, J.B. Pritzker, announced that he was going to close Stateville and the women's facility at Logan because of he recognized that they were dilapidated and long overdue, needed to be shut down. But Michael died because there was no ventilation up there. It was 105 degrees that day. Just imagine that. Michael literally suffocated to death on the highest gallery in Stateville. I can't help but think if this prison would have been shut down sooner, Michael would still be alive. Like I said, you know, I fought after Michael died, I had a town hall meeting at Northwestern. And in that moment, this movement that I spoke about, the Build Communities Not Prisons, was birthed. And it lit a fire in me. And I've always been an organizer while I was in there, but this was something different, something that I knew I had to do to get Stateville closed and get it closed immediately. So I did a number of things. I had people come with me to protest in front of the State of Illinois building. And we had a nice group out there, media was there. We went to Stateville, did a car caravan. We've done emails. We have done a lot of things. We wrote written letters, all in an effort to get Stateville closed. I worked also with a group of attorneys that had litigation going for a condition suit at Stateville. And this, I want you to also bear in mind that this lawsuit had been pending for almost 7 years. This has been telling the federal court, which Ryan was talking about, telling the court that the prison needed to be shut down because it had everything from black mold, it had water filled with toxins and heavy metals. I myself, when I got tested, when I got out, I have lead in my system, all due to the water that I didn't try not to ingest it, but you can't help but do it. I got to wash up with it, brush my teeth with it, and my food is prepared with that. So, you know, I want to touch on the fact that Michael's death intersects with a lot of other things. It intersects with environmental injustice. It intersects with the way that we have our carceral system set up to deprive people of mental health services. Michael suffered from mental health as well. So, you know, it's a lot of things that are connected to the abolitionist movement. And I just think that, you know, the courts is a good vehicle to bring that to challenge it in a way that you can get some sense of justice. Because justice really, it's an abstract and obscure term that we use so readily, but truly is justice. For example, for me, I was locked up 42 years. Whatever amount of money you give me is not going to give me back my time. You know, is that justice that they give me whatever, $42 million? No. Give me back those years. And there's a lot of people in there that are suffering, spending decades needlessly withering away under the worst conditions. And I can't understand why we as a society can't say enough is enough. We need to shut these prisons down. We need to find a better way to incarcerate, and we need to have pathways for release. And that's something that I'm going to do. I worked with attorneys from Lovey and Lovey to get a court order done, a preliminary injunction, and we were successful with it. The judge finally recognized that, hey, Stateville was long overdue, needed to be shut down, they shut it down. He ordered that by September 30th, it'd be closed. But as always the case is, there's this residual effect that happens. I heard the union yesterday had a rally and a demonstration saying that the prison should remain open because their lives were being disrupted, that their children would have to maybe relocate to another school, they may have to move, et cetera, and so forth. Some of them said they may even lose their job. Not one time did they ever mention the individuals in there and the conditions in which they had to suffer for all those years. And to that point, those that are in there right now are being transferred slowly to other prisons. And because there is this clashing between the staff and those that are incarcerated, they are doing it arbitrarily. People are losing pictures and legal work and so many other things that they value they have to get rid of or just being taken from them simply because they're upset that the prison is going to be closed down. And I can't really understand how they can put themselves before another human being simply because of their worst act that they were accused of and convicted of. I was there for a long time, and I know that there's many individuals that are deserving to come out here. I talked about me having an undergrad degree, et cetera. There's a whole lot of individuals in there, both in the men and the women's prison, who have higher education, who have quote-unquote fulfilled rehabilitation. I don't want to get too deep into the law, but I want to say this, that our punitive system is based on a philosopher named Jeremy Bentham, who came up and said, why is morally acceptable to punish someone the way that we do? And that is incapacitation, and they have to do retribution, deterrence, and rehabilitation. In our country, we focused on two things, the incapacitation and the deterrence. Deterrence, any scholar will tell you, deterrence is a fallacy. No way does incarcerating people deter someone else. No way does natural life without parole, the death penalty, or any other de facto type sentence deter anyone from committing a crime. And I don't understand how we still have that as one of our tenets that we stand on. You hear it time and time again from this, not only this Supreme Court, but from when we had liberal Supreme Courts. It's really unfathomable to think in this day and age that we still will incarcerate people and say that they're just waste and can linger there Because if you give someone right now in Illinois 45 years at 100%, that's basically a life sentence. Who's going to survive 45 years in there? Against data, as she spoke about, shows you that you age 2 years for every year that you serve in there. So spending time in there, decades in there, I think I'm fortunate to just walk away with high levels of lead. But I know people that are younger than me, got locked up around the same time, either passed away or are in there, a former shell of themselves, needing hospice care. We have an aging prison, not only in Illinois, but throughout this country. And the burden is going to be on the taxpayers. And the governor wants to spend $900 million to build this new prison. And I don't understand why you can't take close to $1 billion and put it at the front end, and that we won't need the resulting prisons in the back end. You know. So I'm going to leave it at that, and I'm going to turn it over to the next guest. Thank you.
I should not have agreed to go after Jimmy. hi, everybody. My name is Charlene Grace. And I'm going to try to keep it quick so that we can get into the conversation between panelists and with all of you who have a lot of experience out here. I think everyone's already talked about it. One of the things I wanted to say as one of the lawyers on the panel is that being a lawyer doesn't equate to legal knowledge. And I think Jimmy's story talked about that, and the organizing work that Lindsay's doing all demonstrated that. That said, I think it can be helpful. I think there's a role for lawyers to play. And I think also we should think about law school not just as something that teaches people skills, which it often doesn't, but it's a credentialing process. And there is some, like, we have access to people that other people don't, right? We are able to see people, particularly people in the custody of the state, that nobody else can, right? We can go in and visit people. We can talk to people. We can give people comfort. We can be part of movements in that way. And we can also share information and bring information out, whether that's about conditions inside or something else, or just some kind of comfort. And then there, in terms of other things that you do have to be licensed as a lawyer to do, I think representing people in court, right? There's a really familiar model in the movement lawyering literature about law as a shield and a sword, right? A sword because you can do affirmative work on behalf of movements and be aggressive with the law, and a shield because you can sometimes use it to protect people, because we know our opposition is using the law to attack and using the law to maintain power and systems of exploitation. So if we want some shield in that way, it's helpful to have people. And we're in a good position to talk about that in Chicago this week, because last week, obviously, the DNC was here in Chicago. And in my current role, I work at the Cook County Public Defender's Office on the policy team, and was part of the sort of court preparation for the DNC, where there were a lot of things put in place, and it seemed like we were going to arrest 10,000 people, the number of court plans that were in place. And luckily, there were only 76 people arrested. And at the end of the week last week, there was no one in custody because of a DNC-related arrest. And the National Lawyers Guild, which I'm part of, and there are a bunch of other people here who are part of, some other movement legal folks, you know, they mobilized more than 200 volunteers, a lot of whom weren't lawyers or law students, but a lot of whom were people who got trained to do legal observing or other things, and some of whom did have to be lawyers because they either were stepping up for people in court or visiting people in police custody, whether that's to make sure that someone's safe or check on them if they were injured by police when they were hurt, or to relay comforting things, right? Someone I visited in police custody, it was about getting him his fiance's cell phone number because he'd been in custody for more than a day and a half and hadn't been able to call her because we don't memorize cell phone numbers anymore. Although if you're going to a protest and thinking about getting arrested, please memorize cell phone numbers. But like that kind of little human interaction, it's not right that only someone with a legal credential can visit someone and bring that kind of comfort. But it is the current reality, and it is something that we should think about as part of a movement. The other thing I wanted to sort of talk about, aside from movement, legal support, in like a direct protest, criminalization of protest ways, just thinking about legal skills as part of an ongoing campaign, which I think everyone here has already talked a little bit about. And again, a lot of times people who aren't lawyers are in the best role to demystify the law or democratize access to the law. But if you have someone that has a bunch of legal expertise, it can be very useful in helping do that translation and just making things more accessible, whether that's the something like creating a glossary or set of definitions for court watching volunteers, or whether it's getting the schedule of when court happens. Because a lot of times all of you have been court watching, like I'm sure you've had the experience of just going online being like, court's public, we're all supposed to be able to access it. There's no schedule, or it was canceled that day, or it's in a different courtroom than what it says on the website. I mean, there are so many sort of things like that, and it's designed on purpose to be insular and exclusionary. And so I think people who have any kind of access or insight from the inside, getting that out is just such a crucial thing. I also think that something I've been thinking about too is the role of radical infrastructure. And I'm definitely thinking about this because the DNC was last week. And again, you don't have to be a lawyer to help figure out how to get your comrade not slammed with a tax bill for raising jail support money. But it's helpful when you have access to some of that information or when you're building infrastructure. And last week, something that was particularly stark was some of the infrastructure here in the city of Chicago that was built by organizers following the summer of 2020. And I'm thinking particularly about Chicago Community Jail Support, which has been doing jail support outside our main criminal court building for 4 years, pretty steadily, and is doing that every day for people who are experiencing criminalization, but then is also able to help train people in this moment of political activation and then provide, like, sort of transfer their expertise, their knowledge, their resources into a short-term mobilization that's more expansive, that was able to greet, you know, the 70-plus people arrested when they were released from police custody last week during the DNC. All right. And I think one of the things that Lindsay talked about that has been on my mind a lot, too, is just dealing with the law and how far we can get, because we know that anything we can do in the law, if we're trying to organize and we're trying to change policy, someone's writing the ordinance, someone's writing the legislative language, someone's reviewing it. And we all know that where we want to go, whether that's prison industrial complex abolition or some other form of a liberated world, like whatever step we're taking, whatever we can win in that individual campaign is incremental, but it's worth dealing with, and it's worth engaging with the law. Like for me, as someone also working on criminal legal system issues like Jimmy is, it's worth engaging with the incremental steps forward because there are people inside these systems right now, right? The law is what puts people in jail. The law is the mechanism that police and prosecutors and judges use to put people in jail and prison. And there are people in those jails and prisons right now, and we have an obligation to engage with the law as it is and to change it even while we work towards something that's so much bigger. And I have a friend who gave me a quote that I think about all the time. Actually, a friend who went to law school and then chose not to get licensed as an attorney so he could continue to focus on organizing. And that friend's quote was, if you're not willing to engage with legal reform, you better be practicing your jailbreak skills.
Thanks for listening. If you liked this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.